listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Tonight we hear from a writer who has pursued her passion for a place and a people with dedication and love. Amy Willens, author and journalist, has had a long, arduous, sometimes a static affair with a poor country that has long fascinated the world. She refers to Haiti as the country that made me as a writer. She writes, "I am amazed at how I continue to be drawn to the country and to identify with it, to feel shattered when it is shattered, to be happy on the rare days when things are going well, to be okay in those long stretches when things are pretty much all right." Amy Willens's first book, The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, is a vivid and enduring record of an important piece of contemporary world history. The Rainy Season is being republished with a new post-quake introduction to coincide with the publication of Willens's new book, Farewell, Fred Voodoo, Letter from Haiti, which we celebrate and discuss tonight. Willens looks back and forwards at Haiti, at its slave plantations, its unthinkable revolutionary history, its troubled relationship to the U.S., as well as its creative culture and uncanny resilience. In addition to her two acclaimed books on Haiti, Amy Willens is also the author of Martyr's Crossing, a novel, and I Feel Earthquakes More Often Than They Happen, Coming to California in the Age of Schwarzenegger. She is the recipient of numerous awards, including the Penn Martha Albrond Nonfiction Award, and writes frequently for The New Yorker and The Nation. In conversation with Amy tonight is John Wiener, a contributing editor to The Nation magazine and a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine, where he specializes in recent American history. Wiener hosts an afternoon drive time radio show on KPFK 90.7 FM, featuring interviews on politics and culture. His most recent book is a wonderful and often hilarious book titled How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America. Let's welcome Amy Willens and John Wiener to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Thanks to everybody for coming. The color of the cup matches the book.
I planned it.
The book cover is such a great color.
This is the color of the year, 2013.
It's fantastic. So we want to look at the video clip, but first I just thought you should explain who is Fred Voodoo. And why do you want to say farewell to him?
Well, many people have failed to understand the title because it's incomprehensible until you read the book. Fred Voodoo was the name for the Haitian man in the street used by a much more politically incorrect international journalistic press corps during the fall of Duvalier and before. So they would say, oh, did you talk to Fred Voodoo today? Like that when you came back from a day of reporting, meaning did you talk to a tailor or a person living in the shanty towns or a guy who works in a dry cleaner shop? Basically the Joe Sixpack of Haiti. So what I don't love about the name Fred Voodoo is the implication that everything about Haiti should be packed up into this one word, voodoo, and that every Haitian represents voodoo not because I think there's anything wrong with the religion voodoo, which is its more politically correct and anthropologically correct name, but because It's the word voodoo, which is the word that the outside world has used for the religion the Haitians practice, but which bears very little resemblance. So I don't like them all to be seen as this religion of superstition and black magic that and cannibalism, et cetera, that voodoo has been perceived to be. So I'm saying farewell to that, and I hope farewell to the stereotype of Haiti and Haitians, and I hope with the book to bid that farewell, to teach my readers more about Haiti so that that feeling...
One other preliminary question. What am I sitting next to here? Is this good?
Speaking of how it's not a religion of superstition or anything. This is a... It's called a paquet Congo, and it's an African thing, but it's Haitian. This one, to me, speaks of the tourist trade, I have to say, because it's rather brilliant and festive and has lots of doodads on it. Usually they're like this big and brown. And it wards off bad spirits, and this one is for Ogun. That would be his name in Haitian Creole, but his other name, his Catholic name, because the Haitian gods hide behind the Catholic saints, is Saint-Jacques. So, and he's a warrior god whom I write about in the book. He's a very important fellow. So don't try to do me any damage or ask any mean questions.
And tell us about the video we're about to see.
We're going to see a video of, it's about street boys in Cape Haitian, the northern town, the northern capital, really, of Haiti. And it was done by Alexandria Hammond. I happened to find it online one day, and I thought, oh, this is so much the way I think and write about Haiti, and I love looking at it. And I just recently met these boys who are now in their 20s when I went to Haiti in December, and I went up to Cape Haitien, and I particularly asked for a meeting with them, with Denique in particular, whom you'll see here, who's just wonderful, and I can tell you a tiny bit more about him after we screen the video.
Okay, let's watch.
Thanks.
You have some other vivid examples of what the earthquake did.
Well, the earthquake was truly horrible. I'm sure some of you saw clips of it on TV. But then I got there a few days afterwards, and it was still, you know, bodies lying in the ruins. You knew your person was in there, but you couldn't get them out. So people would be sitting there in front of the rubble waiting to get their wife out. Often they were waiting to get their wife out and also waiting to make sure that the suitcase their wife kept at work to keep it safe, they were going to get, because it had their son's visa in it or it had the family's life savings. So there was also a concern about property after the earthquake for not just people who owned businesses who were very nervous, but also for the little person who didn't have that much but was trying to keep something for himself. And so many people died. Of course, tourists died or also missionaries and helpers. A lot of outsiders died in the collapse of the Montana Hotel. I don't know if you remember that. I had stayed there once, basically against my will, because it was the place where all the outsiders would go and stay, and I always associated it with the U.S. government in Haiti and consultants. And finally, the hotel I liked was just so horrible that I said, okay, I'm too old for this. So I went to stay at the Montana, and that was like... 3 months before it collapsed. So it was very vivid to me because I remember the elevator guy there and I remember the reception desk there. So that was very vivid to me. But of course it was made very vivid to you all or to the rest of the world because it was basically, if I can call them by their name, white people who died, and therefore there was a lot of concern about them. The entire UN delegation was killed, including the head of the UN's mission to Haiti on that day, the Archbishop of Haiti, and these are the notables, was killed in his house next to the cathedral. The cathedral fell down. All the government buildings fell down. The National Palace collapsed and then sat there for 3 years in a state of, it looked like three drunks standing next to each other. There were three domes. It was a very beautiful building. And then they all looked like drunks collapsed in on each other. It was a terrible, terrible time, of course. And bodies were carted out and just unceremoniously dumped near the sea.
So Haiti was, before the earthquake and still is today, a horribly poor country. There are many horribly poor countries in the world, but Haiti is special to liberals, to progressives, to radicals around the world. Remind us why.
No. Well, in 1791, France's slaves in Haiti began a revolution that concluded in 1804 with the independence of Haiti from France and the declaration of the world's first black republic. This revolution was led by Toussaint Louverture and also by Jean-Jacques Dessalines and Henri Christophe, three former slaves who ran this revolution and defeated the world's greatest imperial power and their slave masters and threw off the yoke of slavery and took control of their own government. So that's why it's near and dear to the hearts of revolutionaries and people who believe in freedom and liberty and fraternité.
And you emphasize that although Haiti has always been a poor country, it's been part of the global economy since virtually the beginnings of the global economy.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about, and I do so in the book, about how everybody perceives Haiti as really backward and, you know, the poorest nation in the hemisphere. That's its Homeric epithet. But that Haiti offers so many lessons about things that are truly modern. First of all, there's this revolution. Starting in 1791, if you think about it, that's pretty early for a freedom-fighting nationalist revolution. It's like 200 years early, pretty much. You know, Jamaica became independent from Britain in 1965, just to remind you. So this was early, and it was early for the slave-holding world. And it was one of the three revolutions that really changed the world. So there's that. But I also like to think about Haiti as one of the earliest examples of globalization. And it's true that all the slaveholding nations of this hemisphere were, in a sense, globalized. But Haiti was radically globalized because, as the first step, its indigenous population wasn't just ethnically cleansed, but was basically eradicated. These were the Taino Indians. So from the time of Columbus till 50 years afterward, there were virtually no Taino left on the island of Hispaniola, which Haiti shares now with the Dominican Republic. So what that meant was that eventually when France was ruling Haiti, Haiti was ruled from Europe. Haiti was run, the plantations were run by foreigners, French people. Some of them were eventually born in Haiti, but their ties were always to France. The entire labor population was from another continent. And in fact, very few of the Haitian slaves at the time of the revolution were born in Haiti because what the French masters did was use them up and let them die and then bring in new ones. A fateful decision for the French masters, showing that they did not understand the common humanity that they shared with the Africans. Because an African was less happy than someone born on the plantation with plantation life. And then finally, what they produced, sugar, was not consumed in Haiti, but was sent away to feed the sweet tooth of Marie Antoinette and others on the other side of the water. So it was a very globalized economy, I would say, and one of the first to be so completely.
So after the earthquake, you went back to Haiti. You spent a lot of time there before. Tell us a little bit about your work in Haiti. What's it like for you to be in Haiti?
Well, when I first went to Haiti, it was in the 1980s, and I got there just in time to see Baby Doc Duvalier fall, and that kind of cemented my great love of Haiti. I belonged to Haiti after that, although, as I like to say, Haiti did not return the favor by belonging to me. And so when I worked there at that time, it was very new to me, and I remember it as a time of waiting. And I would go to a place and hope that a person would speak to me, and I would wait, and I would wait. And I was new to it, and no one knew me, and I had a book contract after about 5 or 6 months. Thinking about Haiti, I wrote a book proposal, and I got a little book contract to write a little book about Haiti. And so I just had the impression that I would drive in circles trying desperately to get people to talk to me. And I picked some good people, and I picked some not so good people. But now, when I go to Haiti, it's like I can't even hire a fixer because And journalists do this when they go into a country. They hire a fixer who's a person on the ground who lives there and works there. Often it's a Haitian journalist or something like that. But I can't do that because I say, well, take me to the palace, say, after the earthquake. So the palace had fallen down. And my guide would go like, well, the palace fell down. I would say, no, you know, the place behind where the gate is. And so I would have to take my fixer to the palace. So I'm really very implanted there, and I know where I want to go, and I know who I want to talk to. But also, Haiti has changed a lot, and there was a period while I was having a family in the U.S. where the population pressure became very enormous in Port-au-Prince. People started migrating in huge numbers. A city that was about 800,000 when I first got there is now, they think, about 3 million. So it's, and to see this happen to a place you knew is really amazing. You really understand why people are worried about the population pressure in urban centers and why Mike Davis writes about a planet of slums.
A lot of this book is recounts your visits, your interviews, your friends in the camps, the refugee camps, which are pretty horrible places to live, but you show that they're also communities and that life goes on there. Seems like they must be a scary place. Seems to me like they must be a scary place. You're a single woman, a white person, I believe. Were you scared to be in the camps or in Haiti?
Well, it was weird. I thought I was going to be scared to go into the camps. And at first I brought my my guide, who is this somewhat scary-looking deportee from American prisons, whom I love, of course. He's fabulous. But he looks really scared of Haitians, and he can put on this big frown. He does scare them. But then I realized I don't need him. I mean, I didn't go in at night, and there's been a lot of criminality in the camps, and it's gotten worse over time, so this is pretty early after the earthquake that I started reporting it, and things for Haitian girls especially have gotten worse in the camps. It's hard to protect your women folk from criminals if all you have is a tent in the middle of the night. But I went in the day, and I went in at night a little bit, and I wasn't scared for the tiniest second. And I attribute this to my knowing Haiti and understanding when I should be scared, and also to speaking the language. I mean, if you don't speak the language, you see these people as a mass of undifferentiated others. But if you speak the language, you're immediately communicating, and then Haitians are fun, and they're surprised, and they're a little bit honored that an outsider would come and actually know their language. And then it's all like honey.
Tell us a little bit about the language. We can hear from our your boys
nice.
Talking here there. We hear some French words, but then some we're not quite sure what they are.
Yeah, well, Creole is a typical slave language. It's a mix of everything they had when they came over through the Middle Passage. So they're African languages, which were not all the same language already. And then those languages mixed in with the French that they heard, Spanish that they heard, because there was a lot of Spanish on the island. The Spanish were very powerful on the Dominican side. And a lot of English, too. For instance, the way Haitians say Happy New Year now, there was a U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934. So one way that Haitians say Happy New Year is A pied nouillé, which actually, if you literally translate those words into Creole, oddly means we are going by foot. A pied nouillé. But it sounds like Happy New Year, and the Marines would be driving around in their tanks or whatever they had in 1915. And they would, on New Year's Day, they would go, Happy New Year! And the Haitians would go, A pied nouillé! So that's what you're saying there. So it's like that. It takes up all these things. It's a wonderful language because it's kind of new, since it's only about 200 years old. You can really hear language in formation, and it's a very interesting language.
So Farewell, Fred Voodoo is an account of Haiti in the wake of the earthquake. And, of course, you have to take up the question of the helpers, the NGOs, the do-gooders, and their success and their failures.
Their lack of same.
Their lack of same. The simplest and clearest case of success are the doctors, you say. So let's start with the doctors and with your favorite doctors.
Well, I always want to be a doctor when I'm in Haiti because it's just so nice, you know. if you have some materiel and you have a sick Haitian, you can often fix their lives for them. It's incredible because their medicine is so at such a low level, usually there. So that's I think the doctors really have an optimistic viewpoint about do-goodism and all the things that can be done. So one of my favorite doctors there is Paul Farmer, but he's an institution. So I wasn't as interested in him, and his institution is Partners in Health, and they fundraised a lot, and they got a lot of money, and they actually were able to use that money because they had a vast network on the ground, they had a lot of clinics all over the country, they had hundreds of Haitians already working for them before the earthquake because that was Dr. Farmer's interest, was to have it be a Haitian institution long before the earthquake. So he's one of my favorite doctors there, but he's big.
He's also a Harvard professor.
Yeah, he's a giant big deal. He's more like the Catholic Church, you know. He's huge. But then there's this doctor I met who came in right after the earthquake, and she's an infectious diseases specialist. I hate to say this, but she's also a Harvard graduate. But then she went on to more illustrious things. She went to Oxford. So she's better than Paul Farmer. And she came in right after the earthquake, and infectious diseases, right after an event like that, is not the most important thing you can be involved in. And she had to do orthopedics and triage. That's what you really do right after an event like this. But then slowly, as things normalized a little bit and amputations were performed, etc., she got to see all these TB patients, tuberculosis patients, and she's a tuberculosis expert. Her name is Megan Coffey. And she just kind of stayed there. The reason I found her is my brother went down. He's a cardiologist, and he went down after the earthquake at my urging. And he met Megan, and then he left to go back lead his life. And Megan was still there, and then he came back again, and then Megan was still there. And he said, she's the only foreign doctor still in Haiti, and so I wanted to meet her. And she stayed on, and she has such incredible staying power, perseverance. I think she's very brilliant, but I can't tell with doctors. And she let Haiti teach her how to deal with Haiti. And it was a very organic relationship between her and her patients, her and her patients' families. And eventually she ended up, she thought they were taking down the tent that the TB ward was in. It was the only TB ward in all of Port-au-Prince. It was the first time that the Haitian National Hospital had a tuberculosis ward, even though tuberculosis is one of the worst problems in Haiti. So there was Megan, and she's watching. They're taking down the tuberculosis tent at the hospital administration. She doesn't understand. And she sees they're starting to build something. And she and her patients, who have been moved to some ad hoc ward, are all talking about, what are they building that's so important? They built her a TB ward. So now she's running a semi-permanent, possibly a permanent, tuberculosis ward there. She's still there 3 years after, and she's just this great character, and I write about her. She's a recurring figure in the book.
So Megan Coffey is outside do-gooders at their best.
Yes, she is.
You also are concerned with people who are not so good for Haiti. There's a problem with do-gooders, you say. And you talk about something you call the zest of altruism, which brings people there. But let's talk about the people who aren't so successful and why you think that is.
Well, another thing about Megan is she, in a sense, you could say she speaks Creole. That is to say, she makes herself perfectly well understood, but her Creole is so scary to hear. But her patients, they love it because they can, and she says this, she's very self-aware. She says, you know, my Creole is bad, so they have to help me. So that involves them. And she says, my Creole is so bad, it means that HIV-positive patients are starting to talk about their HIV positivity, which is really a no-go area in Haiti, because they have to make me understand. So now it's become an open thing in her ward. Everybody talks about that. But the problem with a lot of the do-gooders who came in, one of the problems is largeness. If you come in as the International Red Cross and you only had 13 people on the ground in all of Haiti before the earthquake.
The Red Cross only had 13 people in Haiti?
The IRC. I don't know about the
American.
The International
Red Cross? Yeah, and yet we gave them tens of millions of
dollars.
Millions
and millions. Tens of millions. Hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions.
And they still have hundreds of millions in their treasury, in their bank, because they have not figured out how to spend it properly. And I can understand that. They don't really know exactly what they're doing. And they've spread themselves thin. And it's not just the IRC. It's a lot of different groups who have this problem. And you want to be kind to them and say, we know you came in for good reasons. And I'm sure they did. I have no doubt about that. But the essential problem is not knowing Haiti. Or anyway, that's how I, a person who knows Haiti, thinks. Because what I see is people coming in to Haiti and then an extreme reluctance to use Haitian know-how, Haitian understanding, Haitian culture, and in fact Haitians, to rebuild Haiti. And I think that comes from, there are many reasons for it. The first one is an inherent racism and fear of poor people at the same time. So the first thing that happened was relief, and the U.S. gave lots and lots of money for relief in Haiti, but 60% of the monies for relief went to the State Department. To the Defense Department to go in and make sure that property was secured and that the streets were safe and that there wasn't looting and such. You know, because
60% of United States government aid
of relief,
to Haiti.
Just relief. Not all
relief,
aid, but relief.
To Haiti.
Targeted relief money.
Went to the United States Defense Department.
To protect. But they were in Haiti. It's not like it went to the Defense Department for hanging out in Washington. It went to the Defense Department because they put the 82nd Airborne on the ground in Haiti to protect, basically to protect property, I would have to say, and also to make sure there weren't mass killings. But there was only outsiders would expect there to be mass killings in Haiti after an earthquake. I mean, Ann Applebaum, the kind of conservative commentator, said, I've never been this worried after a natural disaster. I don't know she had any grounds to be this worried after a natural disaster, except it was Haiti, and so therefore it was poor and it was black, and who knew what these people, she expected mass riots, but there weren't. You know, and there weren't, not because the 82nd Airborne was there, but there weren't because everybody was burying their dead and figuring out how to deal with the earthquake. Nobody had time to riot. Nobody was, what would the riot be about? You don't just riot. So there was that kind of thing. But then there was what I call the compound life. I took that from a journalist named Rowan Garrity. The compound life is the life you lead as a do-gooder in Haiti, especially after the earthquake, where you live in a gated community, quite luxurious. I visited many friends in these communities. A lot of them sprang up after the earthquake. So you live in a gated community, you drive in a great big white, we call them embassy cars, but they're like Nissan Patrols or something like that. With the air conditioning on, you go, you look at what you're dealing with. And maybe you get out with a bunch of security guys and go into a camp if you're really trying hard. And then you go back to the cluster. That's what it's called, the cluster. And you discuss whatever your cluster discusses, like rape victims or rice distributions. And you don't, you know, you're lucky if you have a Haitian in there. There's a quote from a book by Jonathan Katz. He's written a book about the earthquake. He was the AP correspondent there, where he quotes someone in one of these clusters as saying, well, how would we know what to do? None of us has been here for more than 3 weeks, and the director of the program hasn't even bothered to arrive. So it was that kind of thing. I know personally for a fact that the president of Haiti used to drive around trying to find out where the UN meeting was, where they were deciding what to do with the money for reconstruction in Haiti. So it wasn't a pretty scene. It was wrong to try to distribute the monies this way. But what I don't want is for my argument about how the monies were spent in Haiti after the earthquake to become a part of a right-wing narrative that says we should no longer have foreign aid because these people don't know how to deal with foreign aid. I want the way foreign aid is distributed, used, and organized to be more thoughtful and intelligent. And what amazes me is it's the same argument I was making 20 years ago. And all these development people, as Sean Penn said to me, he said, the people from, you know, these NGOs, non-governmental organizations, are always trying to teach me development 1A. You know, he said, I know it already. But they haven't really learned it. You know, all these things we've been talking about for 20 years, involving the people on the ground, dealing with the national culture. It doesn't seem to have really been absorbed.
The most amazing part of your book, to me, is the way you put yourself in it. You sort of have to put yourself in it, since your book is about outsiders in Haiti and why they're there and what they're doing.
Right, I'm part of the problem.
You have a, you know, you take up the challenge. You ask, what are you doing there? And what's your answer?
Well, my answer in the book is, I still don't know, after 25 years, what I'm really doing there. I mean, I know what I like to think in my vainglorious moments is that I'm, like, bringing the story to you so that you can know what's there.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I do think it's important, but I know quite well from statistics given to me by my publishers that you are not that big an audience. So I'm doing something, and I think, you know, as I said recently, at least it will be able to be said of me, she wrote about Haiti. So I feel that's important. But then when I look at all these other people and try to think about what are they getting out of it, because face it, it's a two-way street. You come down to Haiti to do good, to give back. First of all, you don't even know what you took. You know, these people come down, they're giving back. They don't know what they even mean by that expression. But you also want to feel something in return. You want to feel good about yourself. Altruism is a great thing, but also these people want to feel good about themselves. And I think they get a lot out of their experience in Haiti. And sometimes I worry that they get more than they actually give back, even though they're the ones with all the money and the Haitians are the ones with all the need.
You mentioned Sean Penn. Sean Penn is one of the famous celebrities who has worked in Haiti, and you have a wonderful description of your meeting with Sean Penn. I wonder if I could ask you to read a little bit of that.
I would be honored. Now, I had a piece of paper in here somewhere. This looks like it. I don't really need these, but I want you to respect me more. So. I wonder about Sean Penn's connection to Haiti the way I wonder about my own, though Penn at least is a doer and a helper, whereas I think of myself in a more clinical way, an observer or, on a bad day, a leech. Penn says that he's in Haiti in part because of a sense of duty, and that this sense of duty is coupled with a kind of narcissism. This is a quote. We all believe that our time is a particular time, and that in that time the wheel can be especially reinvented, maybe by us, he says. He's in his bedroom in the house he rents across from his headquarters, both buildings that did not fall during the earthquake. They're right behind his refugee camp in the Delma neighborhood. He no longer stays in the camp. I came to Haiti by pure accident, Penn says. I'm a victim of optimism. He'd done work in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and so he had what he likes to call a handy little crew. He was watching what was happening in Haiti, and he decided, he says, let's get it done yesterday. He scrambled for a landing slot at the airport and brought in 350,000 vials of morphine so that doctors would no longer have to use vodka for amputations. Except for having had to listen to Jonathan Demme, the film director and confirmed Haitianophile, ramble on about the place over the years, Penn says, I knew nothing about Haiti. He's sitting on his bed. The bedroom is tiny. It's really a portion of a room that's been walled off. His single bed is unmade, and it's got rumpled daisy-patterned sheets on it. I've seen these same sheets in beds in tents in various camps. The black pleather jacket from the night before is lying on improvised shelves. I can see by the label that it is Armani and probably leather with no P. Penn talks on and on cogently about visiting Aristide and about seeing movies about Haiti and reading books about it now and about his camp's relationships with international organizations, how these relationships soured, about attempts to sabotage our work, about how various international groups felt that their work was being usurped by that actor in his camp of gypsies. He puts another cigarette out on the tile floor next to his bed. That's the fifth cigarette so far this morning. I found Haiti was more raw than Hollywood, he says, smiling at the joke, except his point is that Hollywood is really raw. He lights another cigarette. An empty bottle of Guinness sits on his bedside table. A big waterproof black rain suit is hanging from a peg on the wall. In its domination of the scene, the bulky, glistening suit reminds me of the Tonton Macoute effigy in Aristide's similarly tiny office in the old days. In a way, the little room feels as if it's the handiwork of a set director. The sheer mass of stuff seems to elucidate Penn's character and his role here in that specific filmic way. Pairs of reading glasses punctuate the undifferentiated mess. Pairs of much-used boots, similar to my crap camp shoes, stand under the shelves. The nightstand is piled with books, two blackberries, many cubes of chapstick, and packets of Trident. A half-dome tent is rolled up on the floor. Thick extension cables lie in coils nearby. A pin-up of Miss Haiti, whose mother, a conservative attorney, was assassinated during the Aristide Préval era, has been plastered on the wall, the room's only decoration. It's signed, Penn points out, and is a joke between him and a friend who is also a donor to the camp and who happens to be Miss Haiti's boyfriend. Across from his bed, next to the bunched-up Armani jacket, is a big black sentry safe. I imagine it holds a wad of cash, Penn's passport, his supposed Glock pistol, and some rounds of ammunition. Next to the bed, a tiny, formerly magenta rug that looks more like a moth-eaten bath mat provides a touch of warmth. Next to this, the butts and cinders of Penn's now six crushed-out cigarettes lie in a serendipitous ring, like dancers exhausted after some miniature Busby Berkeley romp. Each time Penn puts out a cigarette there, I am wondering about the Haitian who's going to clean up after him. But knowing Penn, he probably picks up the butts himself. Penn lights another cigarette and leans back on his bed with his oceanic hair scrunched up into a corner. He's telling a long story he's told before about how some local guys made off with some of the camp's equipment and how he got it back. It's a funny story, but he doesn't want it published because he has to work with those very people all the time. While he's telling the story, his toes play with the safe's handle. That's how small the room is. He gets to the end of his tale where the equipment is bashfully returned by a man whom one would never think of as bashful. We work with these guys a lot now, Penn says. I think they have a kind of vision. People tend to have a vision, according to Penn, if he can work with them. I'm thinking as I sit on a metal chair, the only other piece of furniture besides the bed. I'm squeezed into a small area at the foot of the bed, the chair's back almost right up against the door to the room. My pen and my notebook, open on my lap, feel to me like ridiculously formal accessories. I should have my feet up on Penn's bed and be smoking a joint or something. When I'm with outsiders in Haiti, half the time I'm in a book by Graham Greene, but the other half I'm in a movie by Robert Altman.
Okay. I think now we have a chance to go to questions from the floor. We have microphones, and we...
No mean questions.
We will have hands, and thank you.
So, Amy, what are we supposed to do?
Oh, well, we can deal with that. I have places for you to send money. But
yes, that's what I want to know, because I did a lot of research. I'm very careful about where I give my money. I want to be assured that it's going to be used well and properly. And after I sent it off to Partners in Health, I never got any acknowledgement whatsoever.
You didn't?
I did not. So
did
I
you send it by postal mail or did you do it online?
Really? Yes.
Huh. Well, they usually acknowledge. I mean.
Well, so I was concerned that if they can't even do that basic thing, where is my money going? Is it
I'll just say this on behalf of Partners in Health online response team. At a party for my book, which I had to hold on the anniversary of the earthquake, I asked my friends who were there to donate, and I have gotten a note about each person's donation. And I know my friends very well. I don't believe that all of these were $1,000 donations by any stretch of the human imagination. So I'm getting those acknowledgments. I think that must have been a glitch. They're having some problems because they raised a lot of money for a teaching hospital in Haiti, which I think is a fantastic idea, as long as it's done in concert with the hospital in Port-au-Prince. And they're doing that. But now they have to get it into operation, and that's hard and requires a lot of money over time. So you can see that as a mistake, then maybe you won't give. I don't see it as a mistake. I see it as something hopeful for the future, but it's big.
You know? And is there any place else?
But there's
in
another place, which is Dr. Coffey's group, which is called Tikai Haiti. And Tikai is spelled T-I-K-A-Y, Haiti. And it's tikaihaiti.org on the internet. And I think it's fabulous. And you can probably communicate with them and do a very targeted thing. I bought a computer for a patient's family. He had died, and his computer was locked, and they didn't have his password. And I bought a computer for them with some friends who helped me out. So there's that kind of thing you can do with her organization if you're interested. Other questions?
I read your...
Where are you?
Right here.
Hello.
I read your answer to criticisms that you criticized the factory that was
making t-shirts. Oh, yeah, you read
t-shirts.
My blog. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I'm wondering what's wrong with a t-shirt factory, and if China has grown to the extent it has in exploiting its cheap labor, shouldn't Haiti exploit its cheap labor?
Explain what this is about, the t-shirt.
Okay, there's a... Haiti has, like, I think one, there might be two industrial parks near the capital. So that after the earthquake, and this is my biggest problem with it, although I don't love it itself, after the earthquake... there were a lot of reconstruction funds given for Haiti. But there were a lot of people operating in Haiti who had been interested in Haiti before and who had wanted to do certain things in Haiti before. And they somehow managed to wiggle room themselves into using reconstruction funds for the earthquake into doing projects that had been conceived before the earthquake, arguing, perhaps rightly, that these would reconstruct Haiti. And one of those projects was the industrial park that ended up being in the north of Haiti, although it was originally planned to help out earthquake people who had been relocated into new townships. But instead of being near those new townships, it was built in the north of Haiti, where there are no earthquake refugees, where the earthquake did not have much effect at all. So, and one of the first, the flagship business there is a South Korean garment factory where T-shirts are made for Walmart. I mean, I don't object to Haitians having jobs, but at all. I want them all to have jobs. But the idea of a job where the amount of money you make is not enough ever to save, ever to pull the next generation out of poverty, ever to send your kids to some school, some ideal school where they might learn something, where so much of your pay will go to transportation and food that the $3.75 that you make a day will not really be sufficient to feed more than three members of your family, maybe. And also... where the T-shirts that you make, maybe you make 20 a day, maybe you make 100 a day if you're really good, sell for more per T-shirt than you make in a day. So, and not a lot more, like $5.50. These are pretty cheap T-shirts. So I don't, you know, there's something in me that says there's something wrong here. And if I were a China specialist, I might feel that way too. And part of what's wrong is not the fault of the South Koreans running the sweatshop, which is not a sweatshop, but is a shop. but it's the fault of the Haitian government, which doesn't have an economic plan for Haiti. So as even the big supporters of this factory will tell you in Haiti, without an economic plan that is broader than this, a garment industry never works in a country to raise the next generation out of poverty. You have to have an apparel industry, and you have to have a plan for your country. And that still doesn't exist on paper in Haiti.
Hey, so I was able to bribe 20 of my students to come. I'm history teacher, so these kids and those kids back there.
Thanks a lot. Hi, everyone.
So, yay. So as we started the Columbian Exchange today, and then tomorrow we're beginning colonization, we teach big history. So by default, all these kids have come in already after 15 years of learning that Haiti is poor because they're always were that way and they're meant to be poor. So I try to break that very like Western view. What could you tell them in terms of like how colonization 400 years ago has both tangibly and intangibly affects Haiti today? And that's kind of a big... And how could we maybe get past it?
Those two things only, though.
Yes.
Okay, good. I hope this means you all get an A. I hope that was the bribe. I also teach, so I know. Well, one of the things that I often point to when I'm thinking about and talking about the effect of the slave plantation colony on Haiti is the fact that when the slaves did finally throw off the chains of slavery and start their own country, they were Well, first of all, they didn't have a lot of formation to be bureaucrats and government officials. They were kind of making it up as they went along, how to run it. And they made up a lot of it based on the French model, which is not the greatest model. I mean, the French Revolution had come and gone already by the time the Haitian Revolution was successful. So there's the French model that they followed that I think had a deleterious effect on them. So the colonial model. And then there's the fact that once they declared their independence, France, in one of the great historical ironies, demanded for diplomatic recognition recognition of the new country that the Haitians pay a giant indemnity to France. And I'm sorry to be dying up here. And the indemnity was for property lost during the revolution. Which is ridiculous in the first place. On the face of it, the Haitians won. So victors don't pay the loser.
And in the French Revolution, do the revolutionaries pay the aristocracy?
I highly doubt it. No, they don't pay. Nobody pays if they won. Okay. Sometimes you help them out because you destroyed them, but you know you won. So that was an understanding between France and Haiti that was weird already. And then, what was the property exactly they were paying them back for? Well, they did burn down a lot of plantations, and they probably stole and wrecked a lot of things. But the main property they were paying them back for, the French back for, was their own selves, because they were property. They stole themselves from the French by having a revolution. But worse than that, if there can be anything more shocking, is that it was a giant indemnity. I can't remember how many billions it would be worth in today's dollars. But it crippled the baby nation. And the Haitians agreed to pay it, because without that, they didn't have entree into the world economy. And it took them, I believe, it wasn't paid off until, if I'm not wrong, the 1940s entirely. So, again, Haiti, very modern, a third world debt to the first world. They were saddled with that from the get-go. So those are some of the effects of colonization. And there are more that are cultural, of course.
Oh, we have a microphone.
Where?
Over here?
Over there. Over where? Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
I arrived late, so apologies
really
if I repeat something that you already stated. Going back to the NGOs and what's these organizations that are trying to rebuild Haiti, what is, I know Lavalas, which is a very popular, the party of the people there that was excluded from the elections, are they being allowed to have a role in the reconstruction of Haiti? And also, I think there were sports manufacturing plants there before, specifically for Major League Baseball. Has Major League Baseball done anything to contribute to the reconstruction of Haiti?
Well, fortunately, Major League Baseball does not have that cross to bear anymore, because the Rawlings company left Haiti during some unrest. So we can't ask the MLB anymore to like deal with their guilt, unfortunately. Although I'm sure the baseballs are now made in some other impoverished place. So we can think about that place when we hit our home runs. And then the other question you asked was good, and I'm forgetting what it was. Oh, Lavalas. So Lavalas was excluded. President Aristide's party specifically was excluded from the last elections, which were not... didn't have an overwhelming voter turnout, something like 23%, in a country where you can really get 89 and 90% participation when an election is important, as this was, this recent one was. So they were excluded. I would have to say, though, that although I'm sure President Aristide would disagree with me, President Préval, who was his successor and was formerly his friend, is kind of representative of the people. He tried to be. I don't know how successful he was, but I thought that he was the most successful president I've seen in Haiti, which isn't saying much. And Lavalas continues to operate under various names. There have been a lot of, typical political battles and fights and rivalries that have kind of riven the party. But it still exists. Now we'll see. There's an election in, I think, another 2 years. And Martelly, who's the president now, cannot follow himself. That's unconstitutional in Haiti. So we'll see what happens in the next election. I'm sure people are already planning.
We're over here.
Yeah.
Hi. I have two questions. One's kind of specific of like aesthetic art history research of like stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I've been like Google imaging and stuff, but I was wondering if there's any specific collections or like research directions you could go for more like voodoo imagery in particular.
That's question number one.
That's question number one.
Well, there's a show, I think, at the Fowler Museum still called In Extremis.
And up right now?
Right now. At the Fowler at UCLA. Rush, because I don't think it finishes on January 21st or something like that.
Okay.
20th? Thank you. I will say right here and in public, it's not my favorite show, but it's very beautiful. It's very dramatic. And I just have like political issues with that kind of way of representing Haiti. But it's great, and it's really revealing. And there are lots of great books out there about art and voodoo. This is a voodoo flag for the goddess, the love goddess, Erzuli. But this is really very beautiful and done by a real artist, but it's done mostly for foreign consumption. So it's less ethnographic than it is fine arts.
Yeah, maybe I could try and figure that out. But yeah, some more.
Let me help you.
Yeah, okay, that's good. I'll maybe ask more specific elsewhere. But also, this is a vague question, so you could take this anywhere you want. But I have this like map in my mind of like the ideology and like theology of voodoo, which I know almost nothing about, of like as somehow like
join the crowd.
Yeah. Of like say like Grand Bois having some sort of like Joseph Campbell connection to this like New Age green man and some sort of like
this is Grand Bois.
Huh?
You have to wind it up.
I don't have a question. Oh, sorry. Okay. I don't know. Can you just like contextualize voodoo more specifically within like New Orleans, like New
Age?
Yeah,
I'll try. Okay. Yeah. But I will tell you this. And those of you who are my friends here will know this about me. I don't hold any truck with New Age. So I know the name Joseph Campbell. There my knowledge stops. Okay. So I can't really help you that much with that. But of course, New Orleans voodoo, or hoodoo, is connected to Haitian voodoo. It's all about the African migrations between the two ports, Cape Haitian and New Orleans. And this guy is Grand Bois. This is a very sophisticated Haitian flag. It's like five times the size of that one that I saw in a very beautiful gallery in Pétionville, the fancy neighborhood up above Port-au-Prince. And it's all sequins, all green sequins. And he is an agricultural god. Obviously, see his little tree? And there's his little mini-me. I don't know why mini-me. So there are always these things in voodoo that, like, you think you know something, and then there's something else new and interesting. Beyond that, I can't really. I wish I could contextualize for you. You'll have to go online more.
One or two more questions.
Okay.
Oh.
You asked earlier why are you in Haiti, you know? And as a Haitian, I can tell you that I appreciate your presence. And also, I appreciate what is it that you are doing right now, because there's a dearth of information coming out of Haiti. You know, it seems like you can see all of the questions that they are asking. They don't really know anything about the country.
I would say.
You know, and unfortunately, the country is right here. It's next door to us. And it's really amazing how we don't really know much more about Haiti. Which is a very, very interesting place, both culturally and in any other ways that you can think of.
Absolutely.
And if we can clone as many of you, you know, I'd love, you know, to have that done, because you are doing a great job for Haiti.
Thank you. I don't even know this man.
You are an ambassador to Haiti, because what we really need at this point, you know, in Haiti is, you know, are people like you that can bring the truth out, that can really see exactly what's happening, and we can, you know, make the correction and the solution, so that, you know, we can have a better place, you know, for Haiti.
Well, we hope so. But I want to answer that with, even though it's not really a question, I want to answer it with something I heard recently from secondhand from my Haitian colleagues in the press, Haitians who are journalists and writers. They said, I wish that goddamn Amy Willans would stop publishing so much about Haiti so we could get our voices heard. Because, you know, something new is happening in Haiti. I think it's a little bit sad, but it's interesting. It'll be interesting for the future, which is there is a lot more Anglophone Haitians now, right? And one of the problems for getting the story out of Haiti from Haitians to Americans was that we speak English and they speak French and Creole. So you weren't going to hear from them, really, unless you spoke French. I happen to be a person who spoke French. That's one of the reasons I got interested in Haiti. But so the French would hear about them, but we wouldn't hear about them, even though they're kind of in our orbit and not in the French orbit. So that's been one of the reasons that I, especially in the 1980s, before other people were so interested in Haiti, had such a free time of being like the only white girl in Haiti. But now that's not the case anymore. There are a lot more voices like mine, and then there are lots of Haitians clamoring for your attention.
I want to ask the last question.
Oh, typical.
One word. One word. McKinley.
McKinley. This is this little boy who's in the book, and it has a happy ending, I hope, although you can never tell till the ending comes. He's a child who was playing in the town of Leogán with his sister, and the earthquake came, and she was killed. I think she was around 5, and he was around 3, and both his hands were taken off, one here and the other here. And I saw him waiting at a Doctors Without Borders clinic right after the earthquake, waiting for his wounds to be rebandaged and to get more painkillers. He was sitting with his mom, and he wasn't crying or anything, just sitting there. Then I came back like 4 hours later. He's just sitting there, except across the way, out of the sun. And no one had seen him yet. No one had bothered. So in a gross dereliction of journalistic objectivity, I scooped up him and his mom with my driver, and we both were like carried away by this, and so was McKinley. And we took McKinley to a hospital in Port-au-Prince, and they, where American doctors had set up an orthopedics camp, and they looked at his stumps. I'm sorry, I don't know the euphemism. They looked at his stumps, and they refined it. It's called a refinement operation. And then I gave his mom some money, and I went off for the day because I was, like, drumming my fingers. I can't spend the whole day at the hospital. I'm reporting. So I went out, and I left them with some money, and then they escaped me, the crazy white lady, and went back to Leogán, and I couldn't find them in my sort of comings and goings. I would be looking for him, but I didn't look hard enough. I didn't have the right means. But suddenly, this last trip, I put it all together. I went back to Leogán. Everyone had told me, you'll never find him. Or some people had said to me, oh, do you have a photo? And I would say, you need a photo of a kid with no hands? Come on. Everyone will know the kid with no hands, right? So I went up to a woman in the middle of town, an older lady who I thought would notice things. And I said, do you know where I can find the kid with no hands? She said, oh, yeah, his people live out in Terre Force. You just drive out there, and then you'll have to walk because they live in a place you can't get to by car. And we went, and we climbed up a mountain. We found McKinley. We found his father. And then through various connections and things, I put them together with an orthopedic group that goes down every couple of months. And he's had his fitting for his prostheses. And I just got an email today. They're going to do both arms at the same time, not one at a time, because they think he can learn better with both. So this is my little actual giving back, because I put the kid in my book. His story is really sad, and I feel responsible for taking his story and not trying to fix his life. So now I'm hoping that I'll get to fix his life a little bit.
The book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.